Welcome to Baseball Biz on Deck. I am Mark Corbett, your host, and with me, I had the distinct honor of having Perry Barber here today, umpire extraordinary and advocate for everything when it comes to women's baseball. Welcome, Perry. How you doing today?
I'm feeling much more energetic after that introduction, Mark. Thank you. I almost felt like I was back on Jeopardy.
Well, that's right. I mean, you are a person of multi-talents. I look across at you went ahead and you were the lead band before Springsteen took the stage. You were a Jeopardy champion. You, as far as diversity and putting your toe in the water and trying different things and actually succeeding at them, excelling at them, that's very encouraging. Wow. Tell us a little bit about that, the Jeopardy thing for what?
Well, I just basically spent my entire adult life doing everything I can to avoid getting a real job. So going on Jeopardy was just one episode. I've actually been on, I think, 6 or 7 quiz shows, and I've been the champion on 4, I believe.
Kicking
so
it.
The money that I've won on quiz shows during my adult life has helped me through some otherwise impecunious episodes, shall we say. And going on Jeopardy was definitely a highlight because I actually was a champion when I was 19 years old. That's in right. 1972 on the original version with Art Fleming and Don Pardo.
Oh.
And I won one game and lost my game that I went back to defend my championship. And then 16 years later, I was allowed to go back on the Alex Trebek version of Jeopardy. And I was pitted against a player who was going for his 5th win. And they had totally revamped the buzzer system. So I attribute my abject failure and going down in flames on that program to that the guy had the buzzer system down to a split second science. And so I started answering questions that I didn't say the answer in my mind. And I did not do well on that 3rd show, but it has bestowed upon me the unique distinction of being one of maybe the only Jeopardy champion that's ever won once and lost twice. Because usually it's the other way around. You have to win twice and lose once. So, by the way, on that one appearance on Jeopardy, I won a grand total of $660. I was 19 years old in 1972. That would have been the equivalent of winning $6,600 because back then it was 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, not 100. And that $660 bought me a sublet just off of Park Avenue in New York for the entire summer and kept me in beer and Skittles because along with the money, I got a year's supply of Rice-A-Roni and Bon Ami cleanser. So I was set for food, place to live, stuff to clean with. And yeah, that one Jeopardy appearance saw me through to my 20th birthday.
That is exciting. I mean, to be able to take that and make a whole summer or more out of it, my gosh, that almost takes me back to fraternity and ramen noodles and beer. Oh, gosh.
Believe it or not, back in 1972, you could eat pretty well in New York if you knew where to go. And New York is an amazing town, and I'm very fortunate to have grown up there and still live there part time.
I want to go back to Jeopardy for a moment. Because, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was kind of the starting point that brought you into baseball. Because
in a roundabout way, yes, absolutely. Because of my fascination with trivia and absorbing facts about things that are totally meaningless until you go on Jeopardy or you want to impress your friends. And so I became friends with a guy named Barry Bell, who was at the time in the William Morris mailroom, which is the place where a lot of famous music agents and managers started out. And at the time, he was the assistant road manager for Bruce Springsteen, who was represented by William Morris. And the road manager, I think, had a nervous breakdown. So Barry got bumped up and became Bruce's road manager. And they've had a 40-year relationship. They're like this. And I became fast friends with Barry because I was Bruce's opening act three times at colleges around New Jersey during 1975. And we just became fast friends. And then his sister wound up hiring me to work for Gladys Knight and the Pips just before I started umpiring. And that was one of the very few actual real jobs I've ever had in my life. And it was a great job. I loved it. I loved working in that office. We handled Gladys and the Pips and the Temptations and a songwriter named Eugene McDaniels, who wrote 100 Pounds of Clay and some other great, you know, songs of the 1950s, 60s. And I learned a lot about music administration, about what happens to a song after it gets written and how it makes money and how licensing agreements work and things like that. So I had a very great time. And when I started umpiring in 1981, my boss there would let me go early to umpire games in Central Park at 3:30. So I had a job to go back to, and they were very generous with. And then when it got to the point where I would say, well, my mother needs me in California because her husband had just died of cancer, and I was helping her keep her ex-husband's business alive, and not her ex-husband, her deceased husband's business alive. And they would let me go for a month, 2 months at a time, during which time was when I started to umpire out there at my mother's suggestion in the summer of 1981. And I think I've probably told you, Mark, but if my mother had not suggested to me that I start umpiring, to this day, I don't think there is anything in my background or my frame of reference back then that would have led me to the ball field. I don't think I ever would have thought of umpiring as something that I would be able to do or enjoy if my mother hadn't suggested it to me. And how amazing is it that she did in 1981 for a mother to suggest to her grown daughter that she should become a baseball umpire? It just kind of boggles my mind when I think about it even now, how amazing it was that she did that for me.
We're all so fortunate if we have parents that are in our lives and who can make a difference. You know, they can open up a path. Pardon me. They can open up a path that we might not necessarily see. One quick story about me. They gave me a tape recorder when I was a small child. And when all the friends and family would come over, I would hide underneath the dinner table and record conversations and then do interviews. little cheesy. Yeah, it was terrible. But it was the advent for me into radio years later. But
into college. Your introduction to investigative recording.
But the thing with you too, I mean, like you said, your mom was opening this door for you in your mind, but then you went ahead and ran with it.
And she regretted it ever after. She'd say, I never dreamed you would be, you know, traveling the world instead of settling down and giving me grandchildren. And I said, but, you know, my sister and my brother did that. So, and you never complain when I invite you down to spring training to watch me umpire some Mets games.
There you go. Man.
Because it turned out she was a huge baseball fan, which never registered with me when I was growing up because I was completely ambivalent about it, had no interest in it. And so when I fell in love with it on my own, because my friend Barry Bell kept challenging me to baseball trivia, and I didn't know any baseball trivia, so I decided to educate myself. And the minute I started reading about it in books, I just fell totally head over heels in love with it, with the lore and the old-time players and the stories about what happened back in the 1870s and the early 1900s. And there's just so much about baseball history that is so revelatory of human nature and of American history in general. And that I had not stumbled upon that until I was 27 years old. I started making up for lost time as soon as I picked up three books about baseball when I said to myself, I want to learn something about baseball so I can beat my friend Barry Bell. And I picked up three books. And from that moment on, I never stopped reading about it. I must have read 500 books in the next year. And that was before I ever even went to see a baseball game. Really? I finally, after a year, I had a boyfriend who was a baseball fan, and I said, well, look, I know who was on third base when Fred Merkle didn't touch second in 1908, but I can't tell you why the fielder throws to first base with two outs when there's a runner coming home from third trying to score. So I said, you have to take me to see a baseball game. And because it was New York, I had either the Yankees or the Mets. And he took me to see the Yankees. And this is 1977. And the Yankees were amazing. You know, they had Greg Nettles, Reggie Jackson, all those great pitchers, Tommy John. But something about them just left me totally unmoved. It was like the old joke about rooting for the Yankees. It's like rooting for U.S. Steel. But I went to see the Mets, and in 1977, the Mets were pretty inept as a team, but individually very talented. And there was just something so endearing about them. And I just immediately fell in love with them. That was the era of Doug Flynn and Frank Tavares and Craig Swan and Pat Zachary and Jerry Grody and Tom Seaver came a few years later. But that was the beginning of the metamorphosis of the Mets from lovable losers of 1962, the early 1960s, to the powerhouse, dark horse that they became in 1969. And after which people started expecting them to win. Now every year we get our hearts broken, but still love them.
Yeah, I won't go down that trip too long, but I know that looking at Steve Cohen when he came in, I felt like, okay, here's another rich guy, but he's a fan. I really felt like he's a fan. He's going to build this team. I don't care if you buy a championship. If you put enough talent out there on the field, great. And it just didn't happen. I mean, he had some really strong talent there. He had some good pitching. But the Mets, I get it. We'll see what happens this year. Because
they had a good year, and getting into the postseason is such a crapshoot now. It's not like it used to be, where the best teams faced each other, and usually the best team won. Now it's like the bottom seed can make it all the way to the World Series. It's just the vagaries of the way the game is administered these days. And yeah, you're right that Steve Cohen actually seems to love baseball and be a fan. And it makes such a difference, when you hear things that the commissioner says about how, Oakland A's fans, they still have a team to root for when the A's go to Las Vegas. They can just switch to the San Francisco Giants. And no, that's not how it works with people that really love baseball, love their team. And he just doesn't seem to grok that. And it's sort of mystifying how he can. But I guess he's insulated from that, by all the money.
I think most baseball fans scratch their head most times that Rob Manfred opens his mouth. And I'm sure he's a wonderful individual and all that, but good Lord, it's like piece of metal saying that sort of thing. And I'd really believe that they should be a little earwick inside of all of these the commissioners and owners anytime they step in front of a mic and somebody should say, don't say that, or give them some guidance, because they seem to lose something there. But I got on the bandwagon, myself and a couple others on the last show, saying, hey, I want Kim Ng in there as my new commissioner of baseball. I thought, here's a strong woman. She's been with Major League Baseball. She was with the Yankees with Cashman and was instrumental in bringing Cole in. She was with the Marlins, and Yeah, I would have left more than I think anybody would when they
and basically she runs the vineyard.
Oh, I didn't realize that. No, wow.
Yeah, she and her husband are vintners, and they put out some very high quality wine. I agree with you. Yeah, it's too bad that there aren't more women in the running for that particular office right now. As with woman umpire on the major league umpiring staff, it's long past time. I was even rooting for Condoleezza Rice to become the commissioner, and I didn't like Condoleezza Rice very much, but that would be a welcome change from, the endless procession of old white dudes that have filled that office.
Yeah, I belong in that fraternity, but I can tell you, you need to ask this. I look across a lot of spectrums, and I'm saying, like, geez, Moniz, this is not the face of the people. This is the face of those walking into the cemetery. And we need live young blood coming into this, and we need good representation, and certainly from women. And gosh almighty, thank you, Perry, for making a big dent in all of this. I mean,
you too for doing your part. Because now we're circling back to the fresh blood, the infusion of fresh ideas and fresh energy into enterprises that are becoming stale or stagnant. Like, not that the All American Girls Classic has become stagnant, but it's become too weighty for one person to shoulder the responsibility for, mostly by herself. And so, yeah, we need to get younger people interested in taking the reins and steering it into, the 21st century, so that it doesn't end, because it's such a good tournament. It should not die a natural death.
I'm with you. I mean, to me, I looked at all those young ladies out there, like I said, anywhere from Tamara Holmes to Oz Sailors to, there's such a great mixture of young women out there who can play the game.
A beautiful blend of the icons with the younger girls mm-hmm. that are just now starting to feel their oats. And the beautiful thing about that is that, especially for people like me that has known all of the girls since they were, 6 years old, that are now of an age where they are auditioning for Team USA and playing on teams around the country and playing in tournaments around the world. And I've seen them since they were young girls, and watching their progress and their level of skill and seeing the way their minds have developed is just been such a privilege and such a beautiful thing to see. I feel like, I don't have children of my own, but they're sort of all my daughters. That's really the way I feel about that. And I'm just so proud of all of them, every single one. And the beautiful thing about baseball is you don't have to wind up being a champion or the best. You can play and still have fun and still derive a lot of knowledge and pleasure just from being out there and being with your friends and or your foes, your opponents. I don't like to think of them as enemies, but your opponents, and playing with and against people in a sporting environment teaches so many useful and necessary skills about how to get along in real life and how to, survive adulthood without falling into madness and loneliness.
Yeah, that's key, and you're talking about facing opponents, but yet having a camaraderie with everybody who's in, whether it's a league or in that tournament or whatever. And I had the great fortune to be there with you and a lot of those young ladies at a gathering one night when we were in Sarasota. And you could feel that. You could feel a connection between all of these players, not just their teammates, but across all of them. And there was an energy. And I felt, again, very privileged to be there and experience that. And I'm hoping that that energy does come through in beyond baseball and somewhat with administration and the development of the future of this tournament for the All-American girls and others as well. Let me ask you something else completely different. One thing I think that's a challenge is that there's sometimes so many different types of leagues out there. There's so many different kinds of tournaments, and I don't think everything has to be under one umbrella, but Is there something that kind of brings it cohesively together where in women's baseball?
Well, there are, you're right about the disparity and the lack of centralization among leagues and groups and organizations. And it's funny, in the 30 years that I've been involved with women's baseball and women who play and coach and are forming leagues and teams, the ones that have worked their tuckuses off to form leagues and have safe places for girls and women to play and play with and against each other, they have accumulated a little bit of authority and power, and, you know, they sort of run their little fiefdoms. And it's not easy convincing them to give up any of that authority to share with other women who have the same goal. But, you know, they all want to. They're all alpha women, you know, they have to be.
Yeah.
And so getting them together is not easy, but we're working on it. But there are several organizations, the All-American Girls, which up until recently has basically been more of an administrative thing. But now that most of the players are, you know, they're very old now and they realize they have to do something so that the memory doesn't just fade away like it did after they stopped playing in the 1950s. So they are getting on board, and this tournament is one of those things. There's another organization called Baseball for All, headed up by Justine Siegel, but that's basically for younger girls, very young girls all the way up to age 18. And that's been fantastic because, like I said, the training and the teamwork that girls have learned playing in her organizations and teams and leagues under her umbrella of Baseball for All, they're now teenagers and in their early 20s and playing the most mind-bogglingly amazing baseball. I mean, I've been umpiring for 44 years, and what I saw last November in Saratoga made my eyes pop out of my head. Literally, they were making really difficult plays look routine. And, you know, it was just another play, you know, and throwing from deep in the hole at shortstop and all the way across the infield and all the things that people who criticize women playing baseball or say, this is why women shouldn't play. They can't make those throws. They can't do this. They can't throw right. Well, yes, they can. They're playing on a 90-foot diamond. And yeah, they can. They absolutely can. And it is just so thrilling to see. And I know that you feel it too, because I can hear it in your voice when you talk about it. It's just the most thrilling thing to see. And I see it all the time now. And I just love it. So yeah, thanks for helping keeping this going. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And like I said, I do want to recognize it. I want to get back to you and your career, man, but I do want to say one more thing, and that is you were a founder with the International Women's Baseball Center.
I was not a founder. I was one of the original board members. Okay. I was asked to come on board early on, and I'm very fortunate to have been invited to do so, because it's the other organization that I was going to mention that serves as a sort of central bureau for information about women's baseball, where the tournaments are, how to join a team, what events are happening all over the world, what Zooms women might be interested in joining, you know, to get involved with, to network, because it's all about networking and opening up pathways and opening up pipelines for girls and women that have previously been very narrow, if not completely closed off to them. So that's what International Women's Baseball Center does. And in 10 years, I can hardly believe what we've accomplished. I mean, we haven't broken ground yet, but we've raised, in 10 years, we've raised more than, several million dollars for the construction of a girls and women's baseball museum, with the only one of its kind in Rockford, Illinois, right across the street from Byers Stadium, where the Rockford Peach is played, which is very poetic and you know, sort of validating all these decades later. And we've also sponsored tournaments, and we started something called Women Baseball Week that's become a worldwide phenomenon. You know, we hear from girls and women's baseball organizations in India and Pakistan and Mexico and all over the world. And it's just so exciting to see the community of women ballers grow and thrive and, you know, come up with new exciting ways to expand.
I'm thinking about your career. I'm going to kind of jump back to that for a moment, because it was back in 79 or the 80s, I remember, that you actually first started umpiring.
1981. I started umpiring Little League out in Indio, California, near Palm Springs.
So that was
it was not a happy introduction. A coach, my second game, he threatened to pull his team off the field and forfeit the game just because he didn't like it that a woman was out there on his ball field. And so I convinced him to let his players play. And it actually was a very valuable thing for me to do, because I'd been raised to be charming and witty, and not really to stand up for myself or, you know, to take a stand or be assertive. But my first game umpire, well, that was my second game, I stood up, not, and it wasn't so much for myself, but for the players, because I saw all of the parents in the stands, and they were not pleased that this coach was going to forfeit the game that they'd taken time out of their busy schedules to get their kids to. So when he said, well, let's go, we're going. If she's umpiring, we're not playing. And I was dumbfounded. But then I walked over to him and I said, in a loud enough voice for everybody to hear, I said, look, if you don't like what I do out here, fine. You know, complain to the league office after the game is over. But I don't think that you should deprive these kids of playing just because you don't like me, especially since, you know, all the parents took time out of their schedules to bring them here. And so, of course, all the parents are like, yeah, and they were on my side for the first, you know, 3 minutes. And then as soon as I called my first pitch, everything changed, because I got to tell you, my intentions were noble, but my execution was very substandard, because I didn't have any training, didn't have any experience. And I'd gone out and gotten a rule book and tried to study the rules, but studying them in a book and seeing them, you know, come to life in front of you on a baseball field under a high pressure situation where you have to make an instantaneous decision, it's not exactly the same thing as reading, you know. Baseball is a game played between two teams of 9 players, which is baseball rule number 1, by the way. So.
I like that.
If anybody asks me what is the first rule of baseball, and you know that, you'll look like a genius. First rule of baseball is a game played between two teams of 9 players each.
I love it.
On an enclosed field under direction of a manager in accordance with these rules, under jurisdiction of 1 or more umpires.
Okay, do you got identic memory? Can you do chapter and verse?
Semi-identic. And I like that word. Yeah, one of my favorite words, semi-identic. Okay. But I am a Jeopardy champion, so that should clue you in.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Oh, my gosh. Well, at what point you sought out a school to formalize your training as an umpire?
Yes, there are now 2 accredited umpire schools. Back then, there was a third that ran out in California, but it was run by the same umpire who ran one of the schools in Florida. So I chose the one that was run by a National League umpire, the Harry Wendelstedt School in Daytona Beach. And right away, I sent off for a brochure and signed up to go, because even, you know, with the bizarre sort of shock of, you know, people not thinking I was wonderful and, you know, that they loved me, you know, all of a sudden being confronted with people who had their veins popping out of their necks and their eyes bulging out of their faces and spittle coming out of their mouths because they're so upset with something I've done. it was a bit of a shock to my system. So right away, I told myself, these people are not mad with about, they're not angry because I'm a girl. They're angry because I'm not competent. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I knew I could change. I couldn't change being a girl, but I could change being incompetent. So that's what I did. I went to umpire school the next January, and I made my twin sister go with me so I wouldn't be the only girl in the class of 150 men. And so my twin sister and I were at the Wendelstedt School in 1982, and then I went back 83, 84, 85. And every year I got a little better, improved quite a bit, as a matter of fact. But I never did wind up getting a job in pro ball. So I just decided to concentrate on college and high school and other leagues, lots of other baseball beyond the, you know, the universe of professional baseball. And I also worked spring training down here in Florida. There were a lot of teams that hire local umpires for games that are not on the Major League Baseball calendar, games like intra-squads and sometimes split squads. And sometimes if a player is rehabbing, they'll want to schedule a simulated game or something like that. So those are the games that I would get called to come umpire. And they pay very well. And, you know, they were a lot of fun. And working them and being able to hire other umpires to work with me gave me a lot of cachet that I would not otherwise have had early on in my career, because I met with a lot of resistance and had to do a lot of convincing to sometimes. But I was also lucky. I had champions, and people at the Mets were always very receptive. And Buddy Harrelson, who I knew from Mets spring training, hired me decades later to umpire in the Atlantic League when it first started up in 1998. And that was one of the most fun leagues I ever worked, you know, because it was so new and of such high caliber. And it was just a lot of fun. And the best thing about it for me was that a lot of the teams were within driving distance of where I lived in New York. So I didn't have to stay in hotels, which gets old pretty early on when you live a life, you know, the peripatetic life, a life on the road. So, yeah, that was a great time. And I loved my boss. His name was Joe Klein. He was the youngest general manager in baseball history at the time when he took over the reins of the Texas Rangers. And then he went on to general manage the Detroit Tigers as well.
Wow.
And then he threw all his eggs into this one basket in 1998 and put together this league of second chances. And, you know, it's still going strong. 26 years later, and Joe died a couple of years ago, bless his heart, but he was just the most wonderful man, and his legacy is the Atlantic League, and bless him for doing that, and for hiring me, for taking a chance on me, and for sticking by me when there were other people in the league. He and Buddy were my champions, and even Buddy would get upset with me sometimes. I remember one play at first base when I called one of his players out, and he came running out on the field. He was managing the Long Island Ducks the first couple of years, and he came running out, and he said, "Perry, you don't belong in this league. What do you think you're doing?" And I said, "But Buddy, you hired me." What could he say?
Oh, my. I love it. So we got an idea, too, of those first days of getting you and your sister school together, umpire school together. Now, did she continue on with umpire as well?
She did for a few years. But, you know, then something really weird happened. She decided to become a nurse and have children.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. I could not understand it. But that's what she did. But, yeah, she umpired for about 4 or 5 years back in Los Angeles. And I would go out there occasionally and umpire some games with her. And, yeah, that was – I loved doing that. And one of the great privileges of my life was back in 2014 was to umpire with her younger son, Warren, after he graduated from umpire school. And he went to the other umpire school in Vero Beach, which is now called the Academy. So after he graduated in 2014, he was casting around for, you know, what am I going to do with this new skill? And so I said, well, you can stay in Florida for a few weeks and work games with me. I assigned some games and, you know, I know other assigners. So I tricked him. I told him we were going to work a junior college game at, it's the school that's right next to where the Mets play here in Port St. Lucie. And very nice ball field too. But so anyway, I said, well, we'll work a game at this junior college. So we're going there and there's the sign for the junior college. And then 100 yards down the road, there's the sign for Clover Field, the Mets camp, which back at the time had a different name. So I drove in there and the look on my nephew's face, like, what is going on? So I got to work a Mets game with my nephew, my twin sister's son. I'll never forget it. Terry Collins was so great. Before the game started, he came over and he shook my hand and said, very nice to see you back, because I'd been umpiring spring training games when he was a manager for a year or two at that point. And I said, Terry, my nephew is umpiring with me today and I'd really like to introduce you. And he goes, oh, please take me over. And he walked right over to my nephew and shook his hand, introduced himself and chatted and let us take a picture. And he was just so, so very, very nice. I'll never forget that about him. But I'm still mad that he let Matt Harvey pitch that last inning in the 2015 World Series. Like, why did you let him bully you into pitching that?
Oh, no. Yeah, well, you know, being a Tampa Bay fan, I think of Blake Snell and I think of Kevin Cash. And there's times I think people are looking at analytics more than they are when you've got a great player playing, pitching on the mound. So,
yeah. Well, you know, I don't want to say analytics has ruined the game. It does add a dimension, but, you know, so does umpiring. And you don't make every baseball decision based on what you know about umpiring, you know. And you shouldn't do it with analytics either. You should let them be a guide, but not, you know, instructions, not an instructional manual. And definitely not on board with it. And that's one of them. And this partnership with gambling concerns is... just rubs me the wrong way so much. It's so fraught, the whole thing. And for the people, the powers that be who arranged all of this, not to, you know, realize the unintended or maybe intentional consequences. It's very worrisome and I don't like it. So I'm glad I umpire mostly amateur baseball. And a lot of kids, you know, who are very impressionable. And I always feel like I have a chance to make them, you know, better people, even if I, you know, don't meet them on an individual level, that just by being out there and they're seeing me and the way I conduct myself, that it will make them stop and think, you know, maybe open their eyes or expand their horizons a little bit, or make them a little less make them a little less intolerant of, you know, something or somebody that's different from them. You know, things like that. You never know what you do as an individual will have an effect, how it will affect somebody else, you know, because I've had people, you know, come up to me and say, you know, something that you did or said to me 20 years ago really did me a lot of good. And, you know, after you said that, I went and did this and, well, at least you didn't become a serial killer. I'm glad about that. So,
No, it is nice when you find out you touched somebody's life and they made some positive choices from it. And
absolutely. Yeah.
I'm looking here now and I want to ask you some. There's so much more I want to ask you about women in baseball, but I got to know a little bit more about you. Tell me about your most interesting game.
My most interesting game.
Yeah.
Wow. There have been a few, but I would say probably that second game where the coach threatened to forfeit, because it really, I feel like it was just such a watershed event in my life.
Yeah.
And I had to go from, make an instantaneous change from being this reconciler, you know, somebody who was pleasant and, you know, tried to make everybody have a good time. And, you know, instead of saying, you're going to have a fucking good time, know, if you don't like it, too bad. But I don't even mean that, you know, there's a way of being authoritative without being officious or coming off as being arrogant, which ticks people off. And, you know, it's not a good way to develop a relationship on the ball field. Right. You want to work in concert with people and make them feel like they're the ones that have the upper hand, when in fact, I'm the one that does. Oh, yeah. Because they're doing what I want them to do. They just don't really realize it because that's the way things work out there. And that's the way I've developed my techniques in listening, giving them, you know, the chance to vent or to explain themselves or to tell me what it is they're looking for, what they want me to do. And sometimes I'll say that. I'll say, okay, I understand you're upset, but what do you want me to do? Mm-hmm. And when that question breaks through, they often have no idea what they want me to do. They just say, oh, well, I guess I just wanted to, you know, let you know that you blew the call, you know, and then they run out of steam and that's the end of it. And you don't have to throw anybody out. And that's the result that I'm going for. I don't mind what some people would regard as losing a little face. Mm-hmm. It's what I regard as seeking a productive resolution. And, you know, if he walks away thinking, well, I won that argument. Fine. I'm all for that. He won the argument, but I know that I'm the one that actually won it because I didn't have to write a report afterwards.
Yeah. Well, I see that could be a challenge. You know, I think of that how many times it's so easy to criticize you and all the other umpires, you know, sitting there in the stands. Oh, what the heck are they doing? Get that bum out of here. You know, and it's so easy to do that, but to sit where you're sitting, you always think of you and the catcher sitting there and you're looking at a ball coming. Sometimes some umpires are looking at them coming up to almost 100 miles per hour. And the safety that you have to do, plus the focus that you have to have on what's going on. I mean, your eyes on that ball and you have to make a judgment call. Keyword, judgment. And judgment means you have to have conviction and confidence about what you say. So umpires shouldn't have
conviction, yeah, and confidence, yeah.
Because that's the thing. But you're wise enough to say, okay, I'm not going to be demure to them about how I am, but I'm going to go ahead and pass.
Oh, no, I can be very demure. I'm a delicate flower back there.
Oh, gosh. No, but to be able to soothe, put the bomb on the angered coach, I think that's a great way of doing it. So I'm glad to see that something you've done.
Oh. Yeah, you want to ratchet down the level of vitriol. And, you know, there's so much free-flowing testosterone in men's baseball. You learn techniques to corral it so that it doesn't run wild and, you know, turn everything into chaos.
Yeah.
Because it does very quickly. Things can turn on a dime. There, I saw, what was it, a baseball game yesterday where players were shaking hands, or was that a basketball game? And all the, you know, 5 seconds later, everybody was on the court, you know, punching and throwing. It was ridiculous, you know. So that's what we try to avoid.
I probably said this before on the show. I was at a game a couple of years ago. Rachel Balcovec was managing over there with the Tampa Tarpons, the Yankees.
Yeah.
And she was managing. It was the Clearwater Threshers, who are the Phillies team. And sadness, the stands were not exactly packed that day. But these two teams have been playing, I think this is probably like third or fourth game in a series, something like that. Ooh. Yeah. And so somebody got hit bad pitch. And the next thing you know, it is both teams piling out onto the ground. And, you know, at this level, you've only got two umpires. And they're trying, you see, making notes. Okay, who do I throw out?
That's the first thing they teach you at umpire school. Don't get involved in an on-field altercation. Step back and start writing down names. We don't get paid enough to get hurt in a brawl on the ball field.
I'm glad to hear that, because I always wondered about the safety of the umpire. One, simply being behind with this fastball is coming at him all the time. But two, when people get so upset. I mean, if they kick dirt, fine, let them kick dirt. But as long as they're not getting physical, that's great. All right. Another thing I wanted to ask you, because, and this goes to your semi-identical memory, I believe, and you umpire for several different leagues. There's probably different rules in each of those leagues, and you have to be, I guess, change mindset, but certainly frame of thought, I guess, when you go from one league to the next.
Yes, very true. Different leagues have different rules modifications. And that's why umpires always get together and confer before a game so that everybody's on the same page. And when I work a tournament, such as the All-American Girls Classic, I don't know if you remember, but there was a coaches meeting, and the umpires attend the coaches meeting so that everything that is transmitted to them, the umpires also get. Again, so that's so that everybody is on the same page. Everybody knows what to expect and what is expected of them. And that's a very important tool for maintaining a smooth progression, you know, from the first day of the tournament to the last, because the more times a team sees the same team, the more heated their interactions often become. That's, you know, the inverse rule of, you know, testosterone in baseball. Somebody probably at that home plate meeting at the game you saw should have right off the bat said, okay, look, we're going to make sure that, you know, nothing happens. Nobody throws at anybody. If I see anything that, you know, sets my spidey senses off, somebody's, you know, going to go. So let's forestall that happening right off the bat and just everybody have a good time, play the game, and, you know, keep in mind that we're playing for the fans, not for your own egos, you know, for your, you know, alpha male, whatever.
Oh, I do want to come back to something I think that's real important. When we talked about the International Women's Baseball Center and hitting the 10th decade, wow, and trying to find ways to introduce young women, young girls into the game if they have an interest. What are your dreams for these young women? What do you see as far as the future in trying to support them?
Oh, thank you for asking, because a lot of people that love baseball and are knowledgeable about baseball have the impression that the women that are involved in it now that are promoting, you know, places for girls and women to play and, you know, hosting tournaments and encouraging girls and women to play or coach or become involved. They all seem to think that the end goal is to get a woman into the major leagues or a couple of women. When in fact, that's, you know, one prong of, you know, what will be good if and when it happens, because our thinking is if and when it happens, it will not be a stunt or, you know, a publicity ploy. It will be a woman who is good enough, you know, to fill that role for that team, for whichever team that signs her. And I'm leaning towards probably like a pitcher, you know, a relief pitcher, knuckleball pitcher like Chelsea Baker used to be, or Eri Yoshida, the knuckleball princess. You know, those are specialized roles, and there's no reason why a woman couldn't fulfill it as well as a man. But anyway, the goal is really to open up pathways for girls and women to play so that they know where to go. If a little six-year-old girl sees her brother going off to play Little League and she says, Mommy, I want to go too. And they say, oh, well, girls don't play baseball here. We'll take you to go play softball. That that should not be happening. Right. Little girls who want to play baseball should have a place and parents and organizations and support to help them fulfill that goal, not to change it, you know, because the carrot of a college scholarship is being dangled in front of you, which very, very seldom happens. It's not right that girls are forced or coerced or convinced to switch from baseball to softball on the off chance that they might get, you know, a half scholarship to school. They'd be better off concentrating on getting an academic scholarship and playing baseball, because in the last 10 years, girls have gone to college. Some girls have gotten scholarships. I don't know that Aussie Sailors got a scholarship, but I know that she was one of the first players at Presque Isle up in Maine. And there were several other women that made their way into club baseball, junior varsity baseball. But now Justine Siegel, who is Baseball for All's founder and works with a lot of mostly young girls, now she has taken those girls that play through high school, and there are thousands of them. And her contention was always, where did those thousands of girls go? They didn't have any place to take their skills after high school. So she got in touch with hundreds of college coaches across the country and sent them letters and said, if we had a woman that wanted to start club baseball, would you be on board with it? Or if we had a woman that wanted to play and that was competent and skillful enough. And she got a list of the coaches that were receptive. And at those schools, she started programs, club baseball programs for women to play. And she now hosts a tournament out in Los Angeles every year for college age women to come and play with and against each other. And everything she does, she nurtures and she grows it and expands it and until it starts to flourish on her own. And then she lets it go. She lets it go and thrive. And, you know, she's like a mother in that sense. She gives birth and pushes her chicks out of the nest and then watches them grow up to be, you know, productive species.
I love that. I mean, because we talked earlier about how some people with an organization, sometimes they want to just hold and keep it, you know, closely. They know how to nurture, but they're also uncertain about how to let go. And from what you're saying, she's doing that. She's giving them an opportunity, not holding them in, but letting them thrive. And then, you know, hey, here's what you do. Go your way.
She's gone about it in a very intelligent way. I mean, she uses what she calls captains. She picks certain girls, you know, at all these age levels that she hosts tournaments for, and she trains them about how to become leaders and how to start their own leagues and how to set up programs in their own communities. So she has little satellite programs, little satellite people all over the country, all over the world that are sort of, you know, radiating her ideas and creating the same kinds of spaces with her imprint all over them. And the rate of growth of women's baseball in this country in the last 10, 20 years has been astonishing to me, because it was so stagnant for so long and just did not change, did not grow. And the same applied to umpiring, to women umpires. We were at a very stagnant kind of place up until about 10 years ago. And then all of a sudden, things changed when Jen Paul and Emma Charlesworth Seiler went to umpire school. And since they two went to school and both got jobs, and Jen Paul is now the one that has a shot at being the first woman major league umpire, because she's starting the season in AAA. And this is going to be her seventh season. And that's about standard for a minor league umpire. Right. 6 to 8 years of, you know, seasoning. But the tradition has women for women to be seasoned beyond recognition until, you know, they're too leathery to taste good. So, but the outlook now by the men in charge of promoting and nurturing an umpire's career through the minor leagues, they now see things very differently. than they did up until, you know, recently. And that's a tectonic shift in attitude that has been very, very important for women's progress and making our way, making inroads. Whereas before we were, you know, shunned and scorned and ridiculed and turned away and strung along. And, you know, the women who came before, Bernice Guerra, Christine Wren, Pam Postuma, Teresa Fairlady, Shana Cook, they all were great umpires, and they could have made it if they just had the support that Jen and Emma, up until she retired summer before last, are getting now. And, you know, it's about time. And I'm just glad I'm alive to see it, because when I started 44 years ago, I wondered, you know, if I would ever, you know, live long enough to see a woman walk out onto a Major League Baseball field during the regular season and take the lineup card. And now I think I've got a pretty good shot. If I hang on for another year or two, anyway.
Well,
it could happen this year. It very well, because in AAA, the umpires are under contract to Major League Baseball, mm-hmm. and the ones that are at the top level of being a prospect are serve as vacation umpires during the summer. They will go up and down between AAA and the major leagues to learn how to be a major, you know, because there's a lot about being a major league umpire that's different than at any other level, you know, the technology and, you know, just the mindset. So anyway, she's solid as they come. She's really, really good and deserves every accolade she gets. And I have every confidence and conviction that she will, if not this summer, then definitely next summer, we'll see her on a Major League Baseball field. And for those of you who are interested, I think her first spring training game is between the Astros and the Nationals at Palm Beach on February 24th, if I'm not mistaken.
All right.
And I checked the other day, the game is not sold out. So there are plenty of tickets still available.
Yeah, I have to make a trip down there then, because, yeah, that's just down the
road.
Yeah,
I was thinking about it too.
Wow. No, I say about Jen Powell, and I think about, you know, all that's taken to get there, and it's finally getting to the point where MLB and others are receptive. That comes from people like yourself, certainly, Perry. 44 years of grinding it, you know, to making the road. Well, it is. I mean, you know what?
Thank you for being polite about it. 44 years of making a stink. Like, I'm a stinker. And in some ways I'm fortunate that I have not been under the in the thrall of major or minor league baseball, because it's given me the leeway to be outspoken and to speak honestly and forthrightly about what I see they could do to improve. And so thank you for acknowledging that. You know, if I've done even a little bit of smoothing the way, then, you know, I'm very grateful for the recognition. But really, it's, you know, the women that are there that are doing it. And I certainly didn't do any of this alone. So I've had a lot of good friends and supporters and other women that I umpire with, and we're constantly supporting each other and, you know, giving each other pep talks. And plenty of times we've all said, why am I doing this? What do I do this for? You know, it's so dispiriting sometimes. But learning to form your own network of support, and even learning how to do it internally as an umpire, that was one of the first things that I figured out. You know, I have to learn how to get through these days when people are just yelling at me and telling me that I'm horrible and that I don't belong out there. And because that's the paradox of umpiring, is that no matter how much you love doing it, you're not going to be great when you first start. And that's always the time when new umpires get so much criticism that it makes a lot of them want to quit. They don't want to keep on doing what they're being yelled at for. But if any of them did, think of how many great umpires just gave up way too early. I think of that, and it just makes me really sad. And that's why I keep reminding people, you know, they may not be the best umpires, but they're out there doing their best, and they need support, and we should support them. And it's easy, like you said, to yell and criticize and, you know, pretend that you know the rules better than somebody else. But in fact, umpires are the lifeblood of baseball in this country. If we don't have amateur baseball umpires umpiring little league and high school and, you know, youth leagues and YMCA baseball and Catholic Youth League baseball and, you know, all those leagues and now girls baseball, and we would not have players that are major league caliber anymore. We just wouldn't. So we are a very necessary component of the overall baseball picture. And, you know, bless the people that recognize that and do offer encouragement and support and training. I just wish more people did. It's easy to be cruel, especially nowadays with social media. But it's also very rewarding to be kind and supportive.
Oh my gosh, I can't think of a better way to end than to say that to that your last phrase there is to be supportive and kind. And that is something every fan, everybody in the game needs to remember. It is pivotal for the enjoyment and just for the camaraderie and treating people right. So, Perry, I could talk to you on and on and on. So, we'll probably talk again sometime soon. I am, again, so respectful of what you've achieved and a lot of these other, you know, young women and what they're doing now and people that are coming up. We just hope that they, too, realize that enthusiasm for it to continue, that we're going to probably need them to get into the infrastructure above and beyond the field to make this grow. But thank you so much, Perry, for being here today on Baseball Biz on Deck.
Thank you for inviting me, Mark. I appreciate it very much, especially when you have other things on your mind. And I thank you for taking the time to chat with me and let me speak my piece and get it all out there. Really appreciate that.
Thank you, man. I appreciate you. You're fantastic. Anything else, any events we should remind folks about? I like the one February 24th at Palm Beach where the Astros and Nationals will be playing with Jen's going to be officiating that game?
Yes, I do not know where she will be on the field. I have it on pretty good authority that she will be on that crew. Very excited about that.
Check it out, folks. Go ahead.
We also have upcoming on February 22nd, we have the 10-year anniversary Zoom for the International Women's Baseball Center. And you can find us on Twitter at IWBC4Me or on Facebook at IWBC. And lots of events scheduled during the summer. And upcoming this summer is the, I think, the 8th or 9th annual Nationals, Baseball for All Nationals, where last year more than 400 girls gathered together to play with and against each other, baseball, all baseball, in Kentucky at the Cal Ripken Complex in Elizabethtown, Kentucky.
Oh, my gosh.
And we also have the second iteration of the Women's World Cup, part two, which started last summer and is now working its way through the final stages to determine the winner that will be playing in, you know, some big event later on this year. But the Women's World Cup is going to be taking place up in Toronto, Ontario, later this summer. So that's going to be a big event for women's baseball too. So lots of exciting things on the horizon. And thank you for giving me a chance to talk about all of them.
Well, thank you for being here. Like I said, it's been a blast. And I'm starting to fill up my calendar just on what you've been saying in the last little bit. So I'm going to make sure I'm able to attend some of that. And I encourage all you boys and girls who are listening here today to do the same. Perry, once again, thanks. And I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Likewise, definitely. And thank you for letting me go a little off track every now and then bringing me back. Good conversation. Good conversationalist. Appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming and joining us here today on Baseball Biz on Deck. That's been Miss Perry Barber, and she's talking about everything baseball and certainly about the strength of what's going on with women in baseball and the growth of that movement. So, look forward to talking to all the rest of you real soon. Remember, you can find us on any of your podcast directories. You can find us on baseballbizondeck.com. You can find us everywhere. Hope you love us, like us. Go ahead and mark that up. And thank you very much. Special thanks.
This boat is on deck. Okay.
Special thanks to XTakeRUX for the music, Rocking Forward. All right, Perry. That was a blast.